Welcome to what is really a special edition of the Issue Is podcast. This week, we are catching up with the longest serving governor in California history, Jerry Brown, who, when we started this show in 2018, was number one on our guest wish list. It took us about 2 years to get him. After we finally got him via Zoom, I started petitioning for us to go to Colusa County, to go to the ranch and to interview him there. I had seen years ago him doing a similar interview on 60 Minutes, and I thought, I want to do that one day because that is a great story, getting to know Jerry Brown in his natural habitat. His ranch is in a remote part of Northern California, about an hour northwest of Sacramento. There's a lot more cows there than there are people. And it's a lot of Trump supporters there. It's been in his family since 1878. August Shuckman, his great-grandfather, created an inn there, which for stagecoaches when there were no cars and people came by horse. And then people started driving and there weren't a lot of roads around there, and it became much more remote, much more of an area for cows. But Jerry Brown has kept it in his family, built a home there during the last years of his time as governor, and then on January I think it was 5th in 2019, when Gavin Newsom took the inauguration, the oath of office, was inaugurated as California's new governor, Jerry Brown moved out of the governor's mansion, which he restored, and into this home. So we talked to him. It's a beautiful setting. He rode us around in his ATV, which you could see on the TV version of the show, which I encourage you to watch. But this is our extended, unedited conversation. It goes for about an hour, and it's with somebody who has done more in California politics than anybody in the history of the state. Somebody who served as governor twice, also served as Secretary of State and Attorney General and Mayor of Oakland and Chair of the California Democratic Party, ran for president three times, ran for the U.S. Senate once, is such a omnipresent son of California and son of a two-term governor. The amount of history that Jerry Brown has seen over his 83 years is unrivaled. And the chance to speak with him is a real treat. So here it is, our conversation with Jerry Brown. Governor, thank you. Welcome back to The Issue Is, and great to see you here.
Well, good to, glad you came from Southern California to this rather obscure spot in Northern California.
So where are we right now?
We're in West Colusa County. Colusa County is northwest of Sacramento, about an hour. We're east of Clear Lake. Clear Lake is the biggest lake, bigger than Tahoe, actually, all within the boundaries of California. That's about 35 miles west. Mm-hmm. And we're, I guess, 15 miles from the little town of Williams and I-5, Interstate 5. That's where we are. We're off a small road called Leesville, and it was where the Leesville-Ladoga stage ran every day. And of course, when the car came, that stopped. And when that stopped, the function of the Mountain House stagecoach stop also ceased relatively quickly.
But so this was in your family back in the 1800s. You first came here, right, to this spot.
My great-grandfather came to Hangtown, or what is now called Placerville. He got there in 1852, and then he worked his way up here and had various pieces of land. There's a canyon named for him about 2 miles from here. But in 1878, he made a trade, and he wanted to be an innkeeper because his father in Germany was an innkeeper, and that's what he had. So he had the eight-room inn, a barbershop, post office. They served food, and people would come by every day. My grandmother always said interesting people would ride by. Of course, not so interesting that when she was 18, she got out of here and went to San Francisco.
And she went to San Francisco, and then that led to your father eventually, and then eventually led to you as well. But
I want to tell you one interesting point, interesting to me. One of my cousins who just died at 96, Lyndon Williams, died 6 months ago. And she told me that her grandmother, Emma, who was my grandmother's sister, she said, Emma always told her, Pat, you be content with your life. But she said, Ida, who was my grandmother, said, don't be content. Don't be content. And I think I've inherited that because my father was always on the move. You know, he didn't go to college, but he went to night law school, worked his way up and started running and got elected district attorney and then became governor. So I think it all comes back to the pioneers that, well, first of all, they came across the ocean, a sailing boat, then came across the continent and I covered in a wagon train and then got up here and survived. And it gets pretty hot and pretty cold and there's no was no well here. They had to get it off for the rain. So anyway, that's the history and the context.
Would you say that you're content now?
I'm very happy that I'm here. This is probably the best time in my life, no question. But I'm not just here looking at cows or chasing the elk away. I'm involved, I'm the chairman of the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, and I do Zoom calls and participate in their work, trying to wake people up to nuclear danger and climate change. I am the chairman of the California-China Climate Institute, and we're doing work there, all through Zoom, of course. And I also am the chairman of the Oakland Military Institute, a charter school that I started 20 years ago, and other things. Right. So when you put all that together, there's a lot of activity that, of course, my grandmother never could have experienced. Right. But I also get the tranquility, the beauty, and the neighborliness of people that live in this area.
So you would say that even compared to the time that you were governor, you're happier now? This is the most happy you've ever been?
Yeah, I would do that. Well, I have to say, when I was in the Maryland primary in 1976, running for president, and I beat Jimmy Carter, that was very exciting. That was a happy moment, short-lived, however.
Yeah.
And moments in the governor's office were very exciting. But there's a tradition here. There's a groundedness. And one thing I like is when the neighbors go by this road, Leesville Road, they'll stop and right. You talk for a few minutes, and they're friendly. Like we had this fallen oak tree, and one of my neighbors with a couple of friends came over and they chopped all the wood. That wood pile over there was not me; mm-hmm. It's neighbors. So that's it. As I said, I know more neighbors here than I did was in Oakland, in terms of the street that I lived on, or when I lived on Laurel Canyon. Wonderland Park, I knew two people. Here, I know dozens of people. All the people I do know are very friendly, and you feel you're connected. And it is rather conservative. Most people here voted for Trump, voted for the recall, are not vaccinated, but are certainly good neighbors.
So what do they think of you?
I don't ask them that, but they're very friendly. They're very friendly.
Neighborly. Yeah. Of all the places, though, that you could live, I mean, you could live anywhere.
I could live anywhere.
You're the governor, and you've done well at the point where you know the entire state as well as anybody.
Or the world.
Right. Why here? Of all the places in the entire world, why here?
Well, it probably goes back to my childhood when my grandmother, Ida, would come over. She lived till I was 36. She died at 96. So when I was a little boy, she would babysit me, and she'd read Bible stories to me, which I found very interesting. And she also talked about the Mountain House and what a special place it was. So it was always in my mind. And then later, probably late 90s, I was talking to my uncle, Harold, and he said, he said, you know, I shouldn't have been a lawyer. I should have been a farmer. Now, from that, I didn't say, well, I should be a farmer, but I got the idea that being a lawyer is one thing, but being more connected to the land, right. that was important. So I got it in my mind that I was going to get hold of this land, and I was going to build a home, and I was going to come here. And I didn't know quite what I was going to do. I didn't know how it would be, but I had that idea about 20 years ago. So I've been working in that direction.
Yeah, and your father didn't love this spot, right?
No, I asked him, I said, Dad, when did you come up here? I said, he came up a couple times, and I'll show you where he probably visited. But he said, too hot and too many rattlesnakes. Now, that's true, there are rattlesnakes here. But now we have air conditioning. We have lithium ion batteries, 91 kilowatts. We have solar panels. We have a well now. They never had a well. So it's a different experience. It was tough. These people were, you know, the heat, the cold. I don't know, maybe they took a bath once a week or a month. I don't really know. But I think my father being born in the city was a little soft for West Colusa County. And I'm sure my grandmother, she lived across from Golden Gate Park, and she loved the fog. And when you sit there in the summer, and it's 100 degrees for 3 months straight, the fog might sound good.
Do you think that your dad maybe liked people too much to be in a spot like this, and you like nature too much to not be in a spot like this?
Well, it's hard. I'd say my father certainly liked to be around people, and he was a real politician in that way. And he was very urban. I mean, he grew up in San Francisco. And so this would be alien. Also, we didn't have the amenities then.
Right.
There wasn't a well. You had to go get it off the roof. The roof would collect the rain. It would go into a cistern, and then you got to pump the water out. So it was a tough, it wasn't attractive for somebody living in the city of San Francisco.
I know you famously told 60 Minutes about your father that because he was governor and a lawyer, you became governor and a lawyer. Is that still true? Do you still think that same way?
Well, yeah, I would say so. I originally wanted to be a lawyer and get married. And then I began to think, well, this life is rather empty. What is it? What does it all mean? So then I said, okay, I'm going to go join the Jesuit seminary.
Right.
It's called Sacred Art and Novitiate. It's in Los Gatos on the hill. Still there, but it's for retired Jesuits now. So I entered that, and my father didn't like that at all. That made no sense to him, that kind of life of prayer, contemplation, studying Latin, manual labor, that kind of thing, in the pursuit of spiritual perfection, spirituality. So, but then, after a while, I said, okay, I've had enough of this. I wanted to do something different. So I left, I went to UC Berkeley, not planning to become a psychiatrist, because I kind of went from the care of souls to the care of psyches. I said, okay, I want to know about, I'm interested in the people, what their drama is, their life, their mind. Okay, so then after a while, to be a psychiatrist, you have to be a doctor. To be a doctor, you got to take chemistry and physics, which I did. For 2 weeks. No way. The chem lab, no, that's not for me. So I shifted, and I took English and philosophy, literature. And then I said, okay, now I'll go to law school. And so, what law school? Well, there was one that didn't have any required courses after the first 6 months. That was Yale. So I went, I got in, and I did that. And then I moved to LA, lived there 23 years. So make a long story short, yes, I became a lawyer. And why did I become a lawyer? Probably that was the only thing I knew.
Right.
I don't know how to, my mechanical skills are limited, but I did know verbal skills. And then once being a lawyer, I got very excited about opposing the war in Vietnam. And so I did some interviews because I had a famous name, Edmund G. Brown Jr. The TV people wanted to interview me. I said, hey, this looks okay. So I said, okay, I'll run for something. So I ran for the LA Community College Board,
right,
which I won, 123 candidates, and then I ran for Secretary of State, and with fully intending to run for governor. So by that time, at some point, I think even before I came to LA, I decided I was going to run for governor, because it just seemed very exciting when I saw what my father was doing and the encounter, the combat with the legislature and my father. It all seemed. It seemed more interesting, and really when it all happened was I was studying for the bar exam at the governor's mansion on the third floor. Very boring. I would fall asleep after about 40 minutes. It was quite challenging. And then I would come down and listen sometimes to my father's heated conversations.
Right.
And that, my heart started pumping. It was so excited, beating. So I said, okay, that's it. Politics is exciting. I'll get through, pass the bar. I'm a lawyer, I'll do that in some way. I guess that was the role model that was in front of me. Not that my father ever told me to run for anything. In fact, he gave me very little direction.
At 36, at the time, I'm sure you thought you were ready to be governor. Looking back, do you think you were ready to be governor at 36?
I know I have a lot more now. Was I ready? I guess I was. I thought I knew as much as the other governors, although my father was older and had more experience. I would say that my eye, my judgment, was certainly inexperienced from what I know now. And if you're talking about running for president and knowing about the Middle East and nuclear weapons and, you know, this and India and China, yeah, no. I know a lot now, you know, at 83 compared to what I was knowing at 38 running for president. So lack of knowledge. First of all, if you don't know, you don't know you don't know.
Right.
And if you're ambitious and excited, oh, you just charge ahead. So that's what I did.
Well, and let's get some of your wisdom now on some of the stuff that you do know. One of the big issues right now is inflation. Certainly news today that's way up. I know in the past you've cautioned against potentially too much spending from the government. Do you think the government is spending too much right now? And do you think that's contributing to inflation?
I don't think that's contributing yet. It might, but inflation has come because of the speed up in demand, that logistical problem of all the ships not being able to unload. The supply chain is interrupted. The Federal Reserve, in order to get things going, put a lot of money in the economy. People are spending a lot. All of that is affecting the inflation. And it's not just California. It's worldwide. So, but my concern on spending is that they don't spend it well. They don't raise the taxes because that's unpopular. So they borrow, and the American people are, I don't know whether you call them conservative, but they're not big spenders. So whatever you think about spending, you're not going to be able to do much of it without offending the people. So you ought to spend it wisely. You ought to build support. I think it's very hard to spend a lot of money in government without doing stupid things. And the reason is there's so many lobbyists and so much pressure to do things that it isn't just rational judgment. It's not, and the governor has to respond to pressure. We all do. By the way, I do want to say on spending, the Chinese are spending more on innovation than we are. They have their 5G system is better than ours.
Uh-huh.
They say they're very advanced in artificial intelligence and robotics, and certainly ahead of us in green energy and solar panels and wind machines. They're working very hard in digital. So we're going to have to spend tens of billions more in research and development, not less. The trouble is that when you start spending on research, then people say, okay, we got all the social agenda. You have to spend money on healthcare, you spend money on childcare, you spend free college. And then I'll say, okay, now you're doing that. What about the military? They want to build hundreds of new missiles. They got a program, hundreds of billions, to have more nuclear weapons to blow the damn world up. Crazy. So right. You can't just spend on what you need. You have to spend in response to the powerful pressures that you face in Sacramento or in Washington.
So do you think the spending plan that's now being outlined in Washington, a multi-trillion dollar spending plan, does that make sense?
Yeah, I think that's a good plan, but they're gonna have to pay for it. And in order to pay for it, you gotta get people to vote for it. And if the people feel their constituents don't want it, then they're not gonna vote for taxes. And if they don't vote for taxes or fees, then they're gonna borrow too much money, and that does get to be a problem. Child care, having a child now, it's very, $7,000 to $8,000 maybe a significant amount of money for child care. A lot of people can't afford that. By the way, they're finding the same thing in China. Their marriage and birth rate's going down because having a child's very expensive. Mm-hmm. So in today's world, in the way we deal with children, they're a lot more expensive than they used to be. And so if we want to have a vibrant population, child care is pretty important. And it's also a matter of equity, because the upper middle class, they get everything taken care of.
Mm-hmm.
So, and as far as education, we're not spending enough. And I don't think I realized this as governor. Teachers have a very tough job. I see that in my school. We should be doubling the salary of teachers. Mm-hmm. It's a tough job. And we're not doing that well in the public school system. Of course, we should have very high standards. And people who don't perform, you should have a way to remove them. So money, accountability.
Well, how do you, you know, the teachers union would fight a lot of that, right?
Well, they'd love the money, but right. they might not love the increased authority I would give to them, to the leaders. The
how management. Do you, so how do you pull that off?
Well, I got along pretty well with California Teachers Association because I was able to raise some money. I was an executive, so I am sympathetic to being the leader and having to make decisions. And if everybody can second guess and shortchange you and block, then it becomes difficult. So I would say that yes, the collective bargaining has an important role to play, but there has to be the ability for management to exercise greater discretion. And it's not just the Teachers Association, they play a role, but the state of California, in volumes and volumes of new education laws over the last 50 years, it's so complicated. We spend so much money, so much staff, just trying to comply with the laws. And the key is what's going on in the classroom. What is this teacher doing with these kids? And are they supported? And the poorer kids, they don't have enough support at home. Their parents are under stress. They may only have one parent at home. There needs to be a lot more support. So there, in many ways, we need to spend more. Yeah. But do the people want to do that? I think it'd be difficult to get support for that. And
And that's the interesting thing about talking to you is that you have a good sense of, you know, are there the votes for that? Does that actually happen? I mean, do you think that there would be support for increased teacher pay with also increased accountability and making it easier to fire people?
There might well be if you put that on the ballot. But you have to get, if the Teachers Association's opposed it, then it probably wouldn't pass. Yeah. So everything is locked in. There are many different interest groups. There's a lot of stalemate in our politics, and that makes it difficult. But I definitely think, certainly with COVID, a lot of kids at home, the parents, they're burned out, the kids are burned out, the teachers are under a lot of pressure. And what's the remedy in Sacramento many times? More laws, more rules, more state looking over your shoulder. But the state sends a representative, sends an email, does an audit exception. But at the end of the day, the classroom door closes, you got 25, 30 kids and one person, that man or woman, and she's, what's going on? Mm-hmm. So I think you need great skill, great coaching, great support, and that's not cheap. And so that I would say that some of my affluent friends can pay more in taxes, for sure. And
is something you did when you were governor. You came in, massive deficits. You left, big surplus. It looking like California is going to have a big surplus again in January.
Well, one of the reasons you have a surplus is the tax increase that I proposed was for 7 years. And it's supposed to expire, 8 years, right? It's supposed to expire. And if it had expired, we'd have a more modest surplus and we'd be more disciplined. Instead, they renewed it. Yeah. And so now we have all this money. And that's what always happens in California. You get into a recession, we need money. And then you get the money, the recession ends, and the recovery happens, and the revenue flows in, and now you have double the money. So this is the problem of balancing a very volatile income stream that our tax system generates.
So you think we should have let that tax increase sunset?
That was my proposal.
Yeah.
I did say it would be for a limited period. That was my belief. But that's not what the legislature wanted.
So what do you think we should do with this surplus now?
I think that's a very difficult problem. It's very difficult to spend money well, particularly when you know it's not going to be there in 2 years. And we have to be. That's the history of California. The money flows in and then it goes away. Arnold Schwarzenegger had a deficit of $60 billion. Mm. The next deficit is going to be just like that. You know, is it next year? Probably not next year, but in the next 5 years. And then we're taking on all these obligations, and so we'll be deeper in the hole. It's not that easy. I don't blame the government, as it were. It's just very hard to manage, very hard to maneuver. We're in a system that easy to criticize, very hard to make work.
So based on what you're saying, should it be more money for a rainy day fund? Should it be more tax rebates?
Well, I think Governor Newsom is doing something very smart. he's putting money into one-time expenditures, and after the year or two, whatever it is, then he's not obligated to continue. And when that happens, there may not be any money. So he may have said it, I know that's their goal. So a rainy day fund plus only spend, not locking in to permanent. Now, I have to tell you, if you double teacher salaries, that's a permanent commitment forever. And that would take a revenue stream. And a revenue stream would take a lot of public support. And I think that would be hard to generate.
Well, what do you think we're spending on now that is unnecessary, or what would you cut?
Well, I think everything government does, most of what government does is pretty good. It's all about goods. That's the trouble. There's not a lot of bads. You want to take out childcare? No. You want to take out prisons? Yeah, we could. But, you know, even when you close a few prisons, then we're going to need more parole. We need more supervision, more reentry programs. Look, it's the modern world, there's a lot of dependency. There's a lot of challenges. And I think the bill for our progress is not fully paid. And that bill is in the form of kids who need a more comprehensive education, mental health. Just a report came out last week, 25% of young people, I'm not sure what the age range was, were suffering from mental health and depression and anxiety. This is a problem. 50 years ago, I don't think it was that bad. So I think there's a lot of anxiety. We've got climate change, you got rising crime, you got a homeless population that they keep helping, it keeps staying the same. So here's my point, that we have a lot of progress, we have a lot of gadgets, a lot of toys, but we have a lot of problems that are part of the modern complex world, and now we're picking up the pieces.
Right, let's talk about crime, because as you know better than anybody, it seems like the history of California is you maybe lock too many people up and then maybe lock not enough people up. In the 90s, we had three strikes law. The Supreme Court decision comes down in the 2000s. You do Prop 57, Prop 47, other things, AB 109. Do you think that maybe we went too far in the other direction? Why do you think this crime spree is happening?
Well, first
now?
Of all, crime has many factors. But I would say you've heard about the redistribution of wealth. We need a redistribution of incarceration. In other words, the ones, they send people to prison for 25, 50, 75 years. Often, after a few years, they're ready to go. They're rehabilitated. And if you have a reentry program and some kind of control and help, you can work that. But on the other hand, now we got all these people committing break-ins, snatch and grab, shooting up heroin on the street, and they just walk out. So we have a lot of, if we took the long-termers and got them out a little quicker, and we took the short-termers, we put right on the street and we put them in, and then we put them in and give them some drug treatment and training. But you got to have the carrot, but you got to have the stick. Mm-hmm. And the stick is, you go steal a car or something, you're going to spend some time. You don't have to spend 10 years. Put them in for a month. And they do it again, put them in for 3 months. And you need a graduated sense. And we have something called drug court. And there's a judge in Santa Clara that works with people who have drug problems and mental health problems. And they come in, he puts some of them in jail, but they get drug treatment, then they go out. If they screw up again, he pulls them back in. He may go in and out 15 times. Some people need a lot of supervision, but you can't supervise by saying, what would you like? Would you like, they don't ask them if you want heroin, but they say, would you like treatment? And the guy says, no, I don't want any treatment. No, we need to say, this is the rule, you break the rule, and I don't call it a consequence, I call it jail, or some coercive environment that could take someone with a weak will, with inability to make decisions, and help them. I think we need, between the lock them up in state prison and just, you know, rotting in county jail, we need intermediate programs. They used to have farms where people work, you know, have to get out there and milk the cows and feed the chickens and get up at 6 o'clock in the morning. Try that for 6 months. But just letting people sit on the street, shooting up heroin, or now that's one crowd. But then you got the snatch and grab. They're organized criminals. And you get, or there's just people who say, I want to go take what I want to take. So you got to deal with each one differently.
Right.
But I would say that the misdemeanor crime, they say, well, we don't arrest for misdemeanors. Why not? It's a year in jail. If you get two misdemeanors, that's 2 years. I don't understand why they say we have to wait for a felony. I think the misdemeanor is a good charge. It was used for 100 years in California. And then secondly, you've got to have a system of training, education, drug treatment, rehabilitation. So you can't just put people in a cell and they just sit there. And then they sit there with a bunch of other characters who can't get their lives together, and you make them worse. And eventually they get out. So you have to intervene in their lives, but you can't just ask permission. You've got to push people you have to push people, that's all.
So it sounds like you feel like there are not enough consequences right now for the crimes that are happening.
That's what I think.
But
I also think you just can't throw people in that county jail in downtown LA. Yeah. That's not any rehabilitative experience. We need alternatives. We used to have it in the state, when my father was governor and all the previous governors, there are 25,000, maybe more people in mental hospitals. Now we said, no, they let them all out. Well, where are they? They're on the street. Well, it didn't work. There's a lot of things we need to do, and a lot of it is politically unpalatable.
Right, because right now you really don't have the legal ability to lock a lot of people up because of mental illness, right? Because of LPS and
that
things.
Had its own problems.
Yeah.
And I don't minimize those problems, but leaving people on the street in a tent next to a freeway, that can't be right. So you have to, and they're doing things. They're building little houses, they're getting people in hotels. So they're making progress. The problem is I'm not sure that the problem will grow in complete proportion to the solutions offered.
So, I mean, do you think Prop 47 is working?
First of all, I did not support Prop 47. I supported 57.
Right, I know.
Because what I was worried about is people rotting in prison for decades, and I wanted to find a way for them to get rebuilt.
And there hasn't been as much controversy about that recently.
No.
But Prop 47's been in the news
47,
a lot.
47, well, that's why I say they can rest for misdemeanors. They say, well, you have to steal $950 to get a felony. Well, if you steal $200, that's a misdemeanor. Why can't the courts decide we want to target retail theft or home burglaries? And if you get caught, we're going to put you first event 6 months, 9 months, whatever, 2 months, do something. Right now, they give you a ticket, and you book in and you book out. That's because we have no bail and no consequences. So that can't work. And I'm not saying that you just sit in the cell and look at the wall. You've got to have activity. You have to work. In most prisons in the world, you got to work. So we got to get the habits. I was in the Jesuit seminary. And that was voluntary. But once you're there, though, you got to clean toilets, you got to pick grapes, you have to work in the garden. You got to wash dishes, you got to dry dishes, sweep the floors, all that. You got to do stuff, and I think that's very healthy. You got to do stuff in the army. Well, we need some version of that. I'm not sure how you do it, because with the current state of affairs what the courts are saying, there's more that can be done if the legislation wants to pass rules, but they're very reluctant to do that. There was a bill to impose a conservatorship, and they think you have to have 8 episodes before you can impose the conservatorship. Well, that's not going to get anywhere. And some of the drug rehab, you got to have 6 violations before they can do anything. And I know people will be horrified to hear me say that. I don't want to go back, as I say, to just locking them up in a cell, but we need some mandatory environment where people whose will is weak and deteriorated by drugs or mental incapacity, they need the help of a structure. They need structure. That's one of the reasons I created the military school. I thought it'd be good for kids to have to wear a uniform and salute and stand up and say, yes, ma'am, yes, sir. I thought that was good.
You know there are recall efforts underway against the San Francisco DA, Chesa Boudin, and also against the L.A. County District Attorney, George Gascon. Do you think they're doing a good job?
Well, I don't want to comment on all their performance. I will say that Gascon had an idea here on the enhancements. We never had enhancements other than 1978. California did fine. And I went to the determined sentencing law, which I did, big mistake. Once they said the term for robbery is 5 years, then they start adding on, well, if you're in a gang, if you did it before, if you did this or that. And pretty soon, a 5-year sentence becomes a 30-year sentence. And Gascon was saying, wait a minute, no more enhancements. He did it rather quickly. And what I do know in politics, it's like leaving Afghanistan. Good idea, but you got to do it easy at go. You got to be careful and move slowly. But I think the general idea of stacking sentences, which the DAs love to do, is not a good idea. Mm. And I understand why they do that. Before we had the indeterminate sentence, the longest sentence, minimum sentence, was 7 years. After 7 years, you could go for parole. Some people were in jail for 40 years. But still, the ones who could shape up got out earlier. With the fixed sentence, and then with the enhancements, you go for 25 or 30 years, and now we have a gerontology ward. Thousands of people in wheelchairs, demented. Mm-hmm. That doesn't make a lot of sense. So I think Gascon has some good ideas. I'm not going to comment on the implementation. But
it sounds like you're saying, though, that you feel like he may have moved too quickly on some
of
this stuff.
I'm not going to be quoted on saying too. No, look, it's hard to move. The system is pretty rigid. It's very hard to change. But it's overboard. I mean, I was a strong supporter of the police, and I am. But police have abuses like politicians. And so we just keep going to one side, then we go to the other side. We got to find that middle path in politics, which we don't find in Washington, we don't find it in California.
Well, and that's sort of a broader question. Is that still possible, given where we're at? I mean, our politics has changed a lot over the course of your lifetime in terms of the way people work together. Is compromise, is deal making even possible in this current climate?
Doesn't look like it. For example, when Obama had a vacancy his last year in office, the Republicans said, no, you can't appoint your judge, even though that never happened before, I don't think, where they just stonewalled him. So then Trump got to appoint somebody, and he appointed a very conservative person. And what that does, that alienates more liberal people.
Right.
And what we need is some consensus. So you don't want to put extremists on the court. You want to put people in that can win the respect and support of the people. And that's not listening to your extreme or what they call your base. Your base, whether it's in the Democratic Party or the Republican Party, is not going to get us the compromise. That is the people like Bob Dole or even Dianne Feinstein, people that don't generate a lot of excitement sometimes because they're not appealing. They're not, what is it, red meat.
Right.
The base wants red meat. And that red meat's going to destroy the country because even if you get the Republicans take over now, then Trump gets in or somebody like Trump, and then the left's going to go more left and it's going to go back and forth. America can't run that way. And I think America is facing a real crossroads on governability. Can it be governed?
You think there's a good chance that Trump gets in 2024?
I'm not in the business of prophecy or prediction, but I would just say that, there's a lot of challenge here for the Democrats.
Why do you think Joe Biden is sitting at 40% approval rating?
Well, he went up a few points the other day, I noticed.
Okay. Joe Biden's poll numbers have not been great.
Biden is the perfect candidate. I mean, he's old, younger than me, by the way. 3 or 4 years younger than me. Yeah. But he is closer to middle America than anybody else. That's why he won. But I think governing, and he hasn't, not free from error by any means, but it's not that. It's a lot of politics is the structure. It's what's going on in the world. And if it's not your time, when my sister was running for governor and Pete Wilson, she lost by 18 points. It was Wilson time.
Mm-hmm.
When Gray Davis ran, it wasn't Wilson time anymore. It was mm-hmm. Gray Davis time. But it changes. Mm-hmm. And, my father was governor, and then Ronald Reagan was governor. And then I was governor. That's a pretty big, and then after I was governor, George Duke Machen was governor.
Mm-hmm.
That is really a swing. So I think when you're, whatever the mood is, you can't buck that. I just have to tell you that. I'm a practical politician, and you got to go with the flow. I mean, put your own ideas forward, but it take skill to mobilize. Even Franklin Roosevelt couldn't get real support for England in World War II, we were isolationists until the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. Okay, then all bets are off, and he mobilized, and we were off to World War II. Well, you need a stimulus to respond.
So if you can't buck the mood of the country, how do you see the mood of the country right now?
Well, the mood of the country is pretty anxious, especially if all these people are taking anxiety drugs. That's a pretty bad sign to me. I think the leaders, McConnell and Schumer, they got to sit down and find a common path. The trouble is victory is what it's all about. McConnell once said, my job is to make sure President Obama fails. Mm-hmm. Well, but then you win, but then you get a Republican after that. And then you get a Democrat. It's going back and forth. So I do think the country is accepting of what needs to be done if they get a more unified effort. And in the vaccine, we've had so much disinformation. That's a perfect example. So if we're going to get extreme disinformation, we're not going to be able to govern ourselves. And we're going to be in real trouble.
What would your advice be to President Biden and the Democrats right now?
Well, he's got this bill that he's trying to get through. I'd make whatever compromise I need to get it. And I'd keep trying to work with the Republicans because even if they don't agree with you, I think it communicates a good sense that we're trying to work for the country. And I think that's where Biden is, and I think it's a powerful message. And I think there are a lot of extremists running around. I think this inflation, to stop inflation, you raise interest rates. To raise interest rates, you make it harder to buy a house. He's in a tight spot. That's the way it is. So I think he has a plan. He's trying to bring down the inflation. I hope he can. He's got to get rid of this logistical logjam, get the stuff flowing. That's all good. There's still a big appetite for his programs on child care, on college, on family leave. Most people are pretty happy with that. So I think he's got a good program, but he has to choose his words and his press conferences very wisely.
And while we're handing out advice, what would your advice to Governor Newsom be?
Well, I think he's doing that. He's being very quiet these days. Watch how you spend that money, because it can, it looks okay now, but 2 years, he's going to be reelected. I feel confident about that. And then I think that second term can be difficult.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, because then you have all right. The money runs out. Also, the longer you're in and the more exposure you get, the more they get tired of you. That was one thing that I noticed after my first 8 years. I think that people had seen enough of me. And the problem is when you get on television, you're on television. And the next story may be a snatch and grab or some debacle, some bad fire, murder, and you're in the news, and the news is bad. So one strategy is don't be in the news so much, and the people will feel better about you. So I think just the association of reality and the governor. So I'd say leave reality over to the side because it's very hard to manage. And when you have something good, tell us about it.
So you think he's maybe on TV a little too much?
He's
on TV a lot more than you were when you were governor, especially the second time.
But it took me a while to figure that out.
Yeah. But you weren't running for president the second time. Do you think Governor Newsom might be running for president?
I wouldn't want to say. But you're a governor, you think, why not be president?
Right.
And that was not a good thing on my part. I mean, running for president in 1980 was a very dumb move on my part. But that's what I wanted.
Yeah.
And, of course, I wanted it because I was ambitious. And had I not been ambitious, I wouldn't run for governor when I was 35.
Right.
So the virtue of my strong desire became the vice of my overweening ambition, and I should have stuck to my post as governor, and then I might have been elected senator, and who knows what would have happened.
Is that one of your regrets?
I don't regret it because I've had a very exciting life, and I got to go work with Mother Teresa. I traveled to China, to Russia. I did a lot of interesting things. Started a couple of nonprofits, and it was good. And I was not politically, I wasn't You know, no one was calling for my services the day after I left the governor's office. So I had to work my way back. And yeah. I started as, I moved to Oakland. I ran for president. I ran for right. party chairman. That's how right. I had to start. I wanted to get back, and it was not a straight line.
Well, and don't you think that maybe some of that time away, though, made you both better. More interesting and better the second yeah. time around?
Well, you see more of the real world. You have to reflect on things.
Yeah.
So it's good to be governor and then to step away and say, oh, what the hell was I doing here? And you get greater clarity.
Well, nobody else will ever be able to do that, though,
because no,
the rules have changed. One of the causes of your life, obviously, is climate change, as we sit here in this beautiful spot here.
Which, by the way, 2 months ago, there wasn't a blade of grass.
Yeah.
It's all brown.
So if you had to say, because it's, I think climate change obviously is hard for a lot of people to understand still. The way it's communicated is tough. I know Governor Schwarzenegger has talked to us a lot about, like, talk about pollution,
right.
talk about it in ways that people understand it. On a real basic level, what do you think is, like, the most important thing that we can do to address climate change?
Well, that's the point. What we can do is reduce carbon emissions. And we do that by the whole way our economy works. And that's why in California we want renewable energy, we want zero emission cars, we want energy efficient buildings. And all of that takes investment, takes creative rulemaking, takes incentives, and takes not just the governor or the legislature, but it takes the president, and it takes China, and it takes India. That's why we had the Glasgow conference, why we had the Paris conference before that. Unfortunately, climate change is not something, well, you can go make it happen. It's the leaders that have to take the intelligent, important decisions, and we get help, and it's very important from the bankers, mm-hmm. from the insurance companies, from manufacturers, the business world. They have to lead the way. Elon Musk, and he's certainly a controversial character, but he sure pushed his car. Mm-hmm. And that incredible boldness. We need the private sector to push us, push the politicians. And when you say the politicians, California's doing a lot. But unless President Biden and President Xi can form a real partnership, we're not going to get anywhere. And the climate, it is a problem because it's abstract. It's invisible carbon dioxide molecules going up into the atmosphere, forming a heat blanket and making things warmer and thereby disrupting the climate. That's pretty abstract.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way it's gonna be handled by leaders, people who understand it, at the university, in churches and banks and all the rest of it. So it takes real consensus, and it takes America, not just saying, China, oh, look at all the bad things they're doing. Okay, they're doing a lot of things we don't like. But if we look at the world, we've got climate, we've got bio threats, not just plague, but you could have bioterrorist threats. We have the danger of nuclear bombs being fired by accident, which has happened to come very close. We got artificial intelligence that may run out of control. We got cyber that can disrupt the whole economy. Sure. And we got space that they're militarizing. That only can be handled, not by Joe Biden alone, but by Xi, by Putin, by Europe, by Modi in India. So it's gonna take a collaboration that doesn't exist at the level we have to. So you ask, what can the average person watching this show, well, support your representatives who are trying to do the right thing, but it's very difficult and it's going to take a long time.
Do you see, I mean, you obviously are working so closely on this issue with the U.S.-China
yeah.
Institute, and do you see evidence that there will be, or are we close to a deal between President Biden and President Xi?
No, not, they're talking, but China is so different than we are. Mm-hmm. And they're number two, you know, they're Avis and we're Hertz. And they want to be number one. And no, we want to be number one. So we somehow that conflict has to be worked out without blowing the world up. That's the key. And people say, oh, we're going to deter them with more nuclear weapons. Well, what does that mean? We're going to fire one, we fire one, they fire one, it's over.
Right.
And there's a lot of people that can land a bomb in California, in China, or probably even in North Korea, Russia. So, and we can land a bomb over there.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't care what they say today, sooner or later they got to say, okay, come on, let's be sensible, let's work things out. We've got to get to that point because the stakes are so high and you can't do it all by yourself. Mm-hmm. This is not like, oh, you're the USC football team, just crush Michigan or Ohio State. No, it doesn't work that way. We got to collaborate. USC.
UCLA.
UCLA.
Yeah.
Whatever. Yeah. The way USC used to be when I was governor.
Yeah, well, I'm a USC guy myself. We got a new coach.
They got a big coach.
We got a new coach. So it's the new era for USC is coming in.
Between two teams fighting on the football field and countries like China and America, it's very different.
Right.
Cooperation, whatever you don't like what they're doing in Hong Kong, the Uyghurs, and hacking our, all this stuff. Okay, all true. But you got to find, there's no answer. But work, what's called a modus vivendi, a method of living together. We got to find that out. And people aren't telling us that. In Washington, they're acting like it's a football game. And if we just hit them again harder, no, it doesn't work that way. It's together or neither make it.
Well, and we've seen with this supply crisis how interdependent we are on China and getting goods from them, right, every day. And if that gets interrupted, what can happen to our economy?
Also, I've read from economists, I can't verify it myself, but we had the deep recession. It could have turned into a depression, but China spent huge sums of money, as did America and Europe, and together we turned a terrible recession. I mean, it could have been a depression, or we had a recovery. Yeah. So even the financial system can't very well work.
So sitting with you was kind of like getting a master class in legislating and leading. Right. What would your advice be to the next generation of leaders that are looking to get into this, looking to do well when it comes to government? What's your advice to the next generation?
I'd say study some history. Look, one thing about being older is you remember more stuff. I mean, I can remember when North Korea invaded South Korea. I was at Boy Scout camp, 1950, and all along. So, but you gotta look at what's a screw up? You know, study, like even now, Afghanistan. We're there 20 years, or if you take Afghanistan and Yemen and Iraq and Syria and Libya, you add all that up, 20 years of war, 37 million people have been displaced. We spent 6 million, we're gonna spend another 2 trillion on benefits, 900,000 people killed, and that's all these wars, but Afghan, essentially, we're there 20 years, spent $2 trillion there. We walk out, the Taliban walks in without firing a shot. Did nobody know that? Did the CIA not know that? What was going on? So I think we really want to understand, how do we make these mistakes? Mm-hmm. How do we screw up so bad? I think that's very important, and we shouldn't point the finger. We should really observe, and I think we're not learning the lessons. We're not learning the lessons of so far, of Afghanistan. Why, how could America spend so much time mm-hmm. and lose so badly? And we ought to understand that from day one. And by the way, it was Bush, and then it was Obama, and then it was Trump, and Biden's the first guy to get out. So in many ways, he did the right thing, but then did he not know when he was leaving that the Taliban were coming in? They were waiting, just saying, wait, as soon as here, we'll move. That's incredible. I wish somebody would just tell us about that, and I hope people, when they study, learn about that fiasco and learn about some of the other fiascos we've had, even in California with the deregulation of electricity. There's a lot of things or some of the educational reforms that didn't go anywhere. I think you gotta look at what didn't work, and then you find more space for what might work.
So if we're studying the history of you,
yeah,
what is the most important thing that you want people to know about the history of Governor Jerry Brown?
That's a good, I haven't thought, I'd have to think about that. I don't care what they know about me. But
studying history is important.
Studying history, well, we got a book called The Browns of California, which is a very good book. I would say what? Well, no, I don't know what the lesson is. I mean, there's so many different things that I did or didn't do. Yeah, I don't know that I have that. You've stuck me. You have stuck me. I'm trying to think what would I like to tell people. One thing I would like to say that there's tremendous opportunity. And while we look at the things that don't work, I found being in California very exciting very innovative, very open. And so the people I work with, it's a very honest government for the most part. It's very honest. It isn't always doing the right thing, but they're trying. And I think I was willing to try things, try new things, try solar energy in the 70s, try wind machines, trying to do a bullet train, high-speed rail. I wanted to have a space satellite. Now, the lesson, of course, is when you do those things, a lot of people don't like them, and so then they don't go anywhere. But I still say you got to keep putting new thoughts out there. Some of them work, some of them people don't accept. And you learn things. I certainly did learn things. By being mayor, I learned a lot about the down-to-earth. This is what government does or what its impact is. Then I go back to the governorship, I have a better understanding. So I don't know, really, what you said, what should they learn? What they learn is that the more you do something, the better at it you get. You can't avoid mistakes, and you learn the most from your mistakes. When you do something that worked out well, it might have been luck. So you really learn more when you screw up and you think about what weren't you thinking about that led you to that dumb decision.
Well, you bring up high-speed rail. Why don't we have more of that done? Why aren't we seeing LA to San Francisco?
Because lack of, it's like climate change. It's too abstract. It's bold. You need 180 billion, 90 billion. But the Chinese have 20,000 miles of high-speed rail. We can't, when you drove up here on I-5, you can't have all these trucks and all these cars. You're going to have to go, you're going to have to rehabilitate the train system, and you don't want to do it at 60 miles an hour. You want to do it at 180 miles an hour. And you can do that, and you can do it with all renewable energy. Now, the trouble is you got to lay your money out in front. Right. And people have been unwilling to do that. So I think it's a good idea. It works in Spain, it works in France, it works in Japan. But it's a tough sell right now with some of your friends in LA.
I know you don't love the legacy word or the legacy question, but is there anything that comes to mind when you think about that? Or?
Well, I know these are going to sound small, but I restored the governor's mansion after 40 years of disuse.
Right.
And it's a beautiful place. It's like a little White House for California. And I came back to a ranch that had been abandoned for 50 years. And now we're making olive oil. We have conferences here with California Native Plant Society, with entomologists. We have geologists who were just here yesterday measuring the hydrology of the mountains here. So this is an active restoration. So that's my personal. Now, for the state, you know, the governors come, governors go. In thinking about what you asked me before about Governor Newsom and all, I think you have to realize governors have limited power. They can make a lot of announcements. Yes, they say yes to this bill. But the forces, the macroeconomic, the global forces, that drives everything. And governors have a limited amount of power. If you look back to Pat Brown, to Warren, my father was able to build a water plan to three universities. There are things you can do, but they're limited. And my legacy, I have to say, fiscal responsibility. Not a lot of people care about the public purse. I don't like to spend too much money, and I felt that way about tax money. And then secondly, climate, the environment. California is a beautiful state, and to maintain the biodiversity, the beauty, and dealing with all these damn forest fires, that's going to be big. And I think I did emphasize environment, protecting the fiscal stability, and getting along with Republicans as a Democrat.
And there is no better example of the beauty of California than right here in Colusa County.
It is beauty now, but I want you to understand beauty is fleeting. And if you come up here in August, it'll be about 110.
Okay.
And we wouldn't sit here this long.
Our thanks to Jerry Brown. If you just listen to that, I encourage you to check out the TV version of The Issue Is as well on my YouTube page, youtube.com/AlexMichelson or theissueisshow.com, where you can see him ride us around in his ATV and see his dogs and just see how beautiful that ranch really is. It is majestic. More next week on The Issue Is. Gonna be tough to top this one. We hope you'll join us then. Hit me up in social media. Let me know what you think of the show if you're able to listen to this one. Thanks so much. I'm Alex Michelson. See you next time.